Welcome to the Sourcing Hero podcast, produced by UNA, a group purchasing organization that empowers sourcing heroes, and Art of Procurement, the world's largest procurement podcast network. I'm your host, Kelly Barner. The goal of the Sourcing Hero podcast is to capture the epic stories of people who are rising up and beating the odds to create exceptional value within procurement, directly from those heroes themselves. Today, my guest on the Sourcing Hero podcast is Barry Friends. Barry is a food industry strategy professional with a background in distribution. In fact, in preparing for this interview, Barry and I figured out that we briefly overlapped at the same company in the early 2000s. Ahold USA, which is a large grocery retailer currently known as Ahold Delhaize. At the time, they were also a commercial food service provider. Today, Barry is a partner and food service distribution consultant at Pentelect. So hi, Barry. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
So I shared sort of a very high level, right? Food service distribution, your brush with greatness, almost working with me sort of. And I joke, but people like to hear about how everyone got into the job that they're in. So can you share a little bit more detail about your background and professional experience?
Well, this may be a little too much information, but I got into the food industry quite by accident because during college, I sold Rainbow vacuum cleaners and I was very successful at it. And I started my own distributorship right out of college. But I also had met a young lady who's my wife of 40 plus years today. And I was visiting her in Wisconsin for a weekend in the summer of 1979. And her mother told her that if she was going to be serious about a guy, you know, really, should it be somebody who sells vacuum cleaners? And I was, I guess I was insulted enough or just liked the girl enough to think, well, I'll show her. And I literally borrowed a tie and a blue blazer and went to the headquarters of Oscar Mayer and Company, which was in the city where she lived, and, you know, filled out an application. And, you know, there was a labor strike going on that day, so I interviewed with like five people by lunchtime. They told me to come back that afternoon. Long story short, there had been some people out of the University of Iowa and the University of Wisconsin who were supposed to start in a management training program that week. And they had two of them at the last minute who changed their minds, and they had a vacancy, and they offered me one of those spots. So it was quite serendipitous because that started my food career. I sold hot dogs and sausages and bacon and ham for a few years and suddenly found myself in the food service distribution business. And well, did that for a long time. And then you and I overlapped when I was with US Foods, owned by Ahold. Back in the, I think it was a 7 or 8 year period where those companies overlapped in the early 2000s. Well, but I moved around in the industry and ended up working for really big companies like Cisco and US Foods. And then about 9 years ago, I had a chance to jump across the canyon, as I describe it, into consulting. And that's been good. Spent a couple of years with a very well-known Chicago consulting firm. And then four other fellows and I created a company called Pentelect, and that's what we do now. We're strategic advisors, principally in the food industry.
One of the things that I think is so powerful about having worked in an industry like food service or grocery retail is that pretty much everybody can relate to it, right? So for instance, based on my experience, when I'm explaining to someone the difference between direct and indirect spend, everyone grocery shops. So I say, you know, the plastic bag and produce, that's indirect. You know, the apple you put in the bag, that's direct. Now, I also think that works in the reverse, and that those of us that have worked in the industry look at the retail experience or the food service experience very differently. How do you think the years that you've spent working in the food industry have either changed your personal consumer habits or changed the way that you engage in food shopping or the retail experience?
That is a wonderful question, and it's really two sides to the answer. First of all, when you work in the food industry, like I have my entire professional life, that, you know, that puts you smack in the middle of the most relatable business in the world.
Yes.
For the simple reason that everybody eats, and pretty much everybody is interested in eating. So one of the fun parts of being in the food service distribution business is that you know a lot about the restaurants that buy ingredients from you. So when you're at a cocktail party on a social occasion, you're like the guy with the lampshade on his head. Everybody's fascinated. Well, can you tell me about this place? And, you know, do they really have this? And, you know, what do you recommend? And, you know, it's a little bit heady. The other side of the coin is that if you're, you know, like me and you're married and time is precious, it's very annoying to the people in your family when you just want to go to the supermarket for the sake of enjoying the supermarket and not necessarily just getting what you need and getting out of there, rather browsing, studying, you know, fussing about the prices, you know, wondering why the heck this place is getting $7 a pound for bacon when the market's $3.50, stuff like that. So it's good and bad, but it certainly elevates one's awareness. And I think that's the case for anyone in any industry.
Yeah.
You know, getting back to the cocktail party example, people, you know, you meet someone at a party, they say, what do? You know, I'm in the food distribution business. Well, who are you with? You tell them the name of the company. I said, you know, you're cursed now. And I say, what do you mean? Well, now you know what a food distributor is, and you're going to see my trucks. And they're like, they look at me sort of quizzically. Mm-hmm. I see that person at the same party a year later, and they say, oh my God, I see your trucks everywhere. Like, you know, it's behind the scenes, food service distributors are, they're not invisible, but nobody sitting in a restaurant really thinks, you know, where'd this restaurant get their stuff?
That's right. That's right. Well, actually, so I would agree with you, with the exception of the fact of what we've all lived through over the last 2 years, because now, even though nothing has really changed, right, you and I know that things have worked like this for a very long time. Everyone now considers themselves some kind of a instant expert in the food supply chain and why there's no toilet paper and all of this. So now it's everyone's business, Barry. It used to be our business. Now it's everyone's. And it seems to be that most of the discussion around the food supply chain is, why is everything so messed up? And it would be very simple to point to COVID and say, well, COVID ruined everything. But do you think that the pandemic and the supply chain disruptions that have accompanied it are really what caused today's food supply chain challenges? Or do you think it brought existing lingering problems and made them more visible, both to people like us who've worked in the industry and also for consumers?
It's absolutely the latter, Kelly. And, you know, COVID has been a catalyst for many things. You know, on a positive note, it's been a catalyst for advancing medical science, you know, really, really quickly. Fast-tracking vaccines and so forth. But the many of the things that are haunting us this year and for the last year or so, you know, with supply chain disruptions and inflation and so forth, are manifestations of problems that were already simmering. And I can tell you that, you know, my firm was doing quite a lot of work in 2018 and 19 around cost pressures and price pressures in the food service distribution business, because companies like Sysco and Martin Brower and US Foods were experiencing, you know, serious margin compression, if not operating losses, on some of their largest pieces of business. And, you know, and these huge companies like Wendy's and Applebee's and Sonic and Starbucks, you know, we're, you know, feeling the pain of these suppliers coming to them saying, you know, we just need to charge more. We can't live with this. And of course, nobody wants to pay more. And frankly, nobody wants to charge more. They just want to get on with life and make a fair profit and enjoy it. So probably the single largest element underlying all of these problems is people. Particularly in the U.S. and in other parts of the world, but more so here, we don't have enough people of working age who are choosing to work. Consequently, there's not enough capacity to get things done. And so COVID, of course, you know, threw gas on that simmering fire that was already going, you know, pretty hot. We, you know, we were past full employment 2018, 2019. And, you know, with a, you know, a huge retirement rate from baby boomers. And so it just lit a fire and has aggravated so much of what was already happening.
Well, and it's funny that you say that, because I know when I get annoying is when we have the news on in our house and they're talking about, you know, very dramatic graphics, you know, the supply chain is broken, the supply chain crisis. And then they go on and they actually dig into the story. And I, of course, listen. And I'm always saying, yeah, see, that's a problem in the supply chain, not a problem with the supply chain. If people won't show up at a meatpacking facility or a distribution warehouse to load and wrap pallets or to drive trucks, that's not the supply chain not working, right? Please, everybody, you know, this is like you walking through the supermarket and driving everybody crazy because you want to observe end caps and look at pricing comparisons. Like, please, in versus with, they're two different prepositions. And it's interesting too, because one of the things that you had mentioned to me previously that I'm going to be honest, I had never thought about before, and I like the way you came at it, is you talked about the fact that most procurement professionals look at the world in terms of supply, right? How much is the supply? Is it certain? Is it disrupted? Is it uncertain? And that's what we focus on when we think about prices and which suppliers we're going to work with. But you made the point that we would actually be better served by paying more attention to changes in other people's demand. Can you talk about that a little bit and how it should alter the way that we approach our work?
Well, you know, just looking upstream and figuring out what to buy from whom to, you know, to have on hand or to, you know, for inventory for resale or to use on an indirect basis is fine if what you need is a highly predictable and constant element. But that's really not the case in so many areas. And when you have, you know, an unusual change in the tide, like we've had with COVID, which of course, you know, changed the way people procured their food and other things. And frankly, you know, what they bought in general, you know, services versus hard goods and so forth. So and really the smart companies do this. They're looking downstream, you know, the now decades old practice of category management and having insights about consumers is a mature science. And frankly, if you're in the procurement and supply chain business as part of a larger entity, and you're not looking downstream and anticipating demand, you're far more likely to run into problems than someone who is doing that.
Yeah. Now, when we think about the prices themselves, and you alluded to this earlier because you were talking about what distributors like Sysco and US Foods are going through versus the actual retailers. I think it was earlier this week, I think Starbucks announced that they're finally raising prices. And I know that companies that are actually consumer facing are always very concerned about raising prices. That's never a good news story to have hit the papers. But somewhere that has to be observed. And there are different reasons for the prices going up. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between where in the supply chain those price increases or cost increases, to be fair, end up being born and what's ultimately causing those costs to change?
Well, there are a lot of reasons.
yes, there are.
And as you said, nobody likes to raise prices other than maybe a small population of evildoers. So let's think about it. If you're manufacturing products that you sell, and you desire to make a profit doing that, which of course you should, then whatever those inputs, those components of the product that you make cost are a very, very big factor in what you need to charge for that finished product. And there are the, you know, they are the ingredient costs, you know, whether it's microchips or plastic resin or wheat or starch or ground beef. It doesn't matter what it is, you know, whatever that is, if you're having to pay more for that, you are either going to absorb that cost or you're going to pass it along in the form of a raised price. Another big cost is the people that we talked about a minute ago, people doing the work. If you have people that are, let's say, earning in absolute terms, $20 an hour in a factory, but things change and there's a shortage of them and wages go up and it's now $26 or $27 per working hour, well, that's a substantial cost that's being absorbed that also needs to be passed along or absorbed. Add to that things like fuel and freight and many, many other factors, and there are real reasons for having to charge more. Then there's the question of shortages. If I am in the business, let's say I'm a meatpacking plant, and I can only get just so many hogs because the farmers can only produce just so many because they're shorthanded as well, and the people that work in my meatpacking plant are not coming to work because they are sick, or I just don't have enough of them, period, because there's not enough of them to hire because we've got a population shortage, then that reduces my capacity to produce whatever it is that I'm making out of those hogs. And, you know, I contribute to a shortage and perhaps my competitors contribute to a shortage. And there's nothing like a good old fashioned, you know, imbalance in supply and demand, which, you know, is economics 101, if not earlier, to mess things up. And, you know, scarcity is sort of the mother of inflation.
Yes.
And if you, if you don't want to raise your prices, but you can't satisfy your customers, you pretty much have to raise your prices because you need to chase some customers away. It's not just because you want to make more money. You may not even be making more money. You've got to participate in that supply demand equilibrium.
Now, let's stay with the idea of scarcity for a minute, because that's certainly something, you know, we think about all the things about supply chains that have hit the general press over the last couple of years. It's always, you know, there's no beef, there's no toilet paper, there's no right this and that. What do you think we as practitioners have learned about the lean efficiencies that we've built into our supply chains and how they ultimately affect us as we attempt to become more resilient to disruption?
Well, you know, lean is a beautiful thing when everything is running smoothly. It's, if the orchestra is being conducted and everyone has practiced, and those clarinets know when to play soft, and the timpani is gently drumming away, and the violins are doing their part. I mean, if everything is in beautiful harmony, lean is desirable and perfect. However, the slightest little bit of disharmony can make that orchestra sound terrible. And, you know, having everything perfectly tuned and just enough on hand and just enough coming in and just enough of this and just, you know, truly being lean, as the word implies, can be, you know, I don't want to say catastrophic, but it can get really messy when the harmony ceases to exist. Mm. So I think what we learned over the last couple of years is that we were really having a very harmonious world for quite a few years. And, you know, a combination of known internal problems and unknown, unpredictable external problems just dropped a bomb in the middle of all that and has taught us that while we still like lean, we need to take steps to make sure that that orchestra is more resilient in its ability to remain harmonious.
Because we also don't want the pendulum to swing completely at the other way and we end up with too much capital locked up in inventory, right? That's not the right answer either. What would you suggest that companies, supply chain teams, procurement professionals re-examine around maybe where they have lean practices in their operation, or maybe how they're managing inventory if they're trying to become more resilient. What are the things that we should look at and decide what it is we're going to change going forward?
Well, I would tell you that's a question that should be approached in a really comprehensive manner, almost as if you would embarking upon a medium to long-term strategic plan. Mm-hmm. Where you really break everything down, you develop, a SWOT matrix, you look at root causes of problems, analyze the risks, and you truly, really dissect, the entire supply chain to see where you have potential risk, where you have known risks, and also seek out opportunities. It's just, take a step back, and then do the work to study what you have and see if there are ways to improve it strategically and tactically so that you reduce risk at the same time without increasing costs, commensurate with that risk reduction, or frankly, have a balance of the two.
Now, Barry, as we come to the end of our time, I want to ask you a question that I pose to everybody that joins me on The Sourcing Hero. And I think it's a tricky question, but I know from the feedback that I get from the listening audience that it's everybody's favorite. Although I do actually have to say, in retrospect, there are a lot of people in procurement that are in the field because they sort of fell in. Very few of us deliberately went into procurement. But mm-hmm. in asking people how they ended up on their current career progression, I do have to give you credit. You're the first person that's ever credited his mother-in-law. So that's a first. That was a big moment for me. That'll be my personal favorite moment from this conversation. But generally speaking, I know what everybody likes is the answer to the question, how would you define, and you get a choice, either what it means to be a sourcing hero or what heroism means in a business context?
Well, before I answer the question, I do have to say that when my wife and I would argue, I used to say, I'm going home to your mother.
That's an award-winning mother-in-law.
Yeah, no, she was great. So what's a sourcing hero? Sourcing, people in procurement are generally in businesses, sort of the unsung heroes of these companies. Because everybody just expects them to do what they do. And naturally, when they can't do it or don't do it, life is miserable. Mm-hmm. But most of the time they do it, and they do it well. So I think that a sourcing hero is that person who quietly goes about their work, but doesn't just do it in a way that meets the requirements or meets the objectives. It's the person who takes the time, maybe it's hours outside of the workday or over lunch, to study alternatives and think creatively and find new ways to do what they do better and create new value for the organization. Identify a new opportunity, experiment with a new approach. Someone who's just willing and able to be creative and innovative and push for change. And I say that all in the context of sourcing hero, because with all due respect, because I love buyers. And in my industry, I used to use the metaphor that, the merchandisers, that the buyers were the heart of the body. The sales force was the legs and the drivers were, you get all these different parts of the human body metaphorically. But they tend to be people that are come to work, do the job, go home. So when you find one that was willing to put forth the extra effort and be creative, they were just worth their weight in gold.
And I think we've certainly seen, over the last couple of years, for anybody that ever sort of dismissed, especially in direct procurement, right? I think forever, many people in our field will be able to say, oh yeah, who do you think secured the PPE that we needed to keep this operation running, right? That's sort of like the ultimate for all of these indirect things that really only exist for the sake of, the apples going in the bag or the floors being washed, staying with our grocery store example. I really do hope that at least within companies, even if it's not into the consumer group as a whole, that everyone has a new awareness of how important it is to have well-managed supplier relationships on the indirect side as well as the direct, and that those professionals who really did, and I've heard a lot of stories, really did go above and beyond to help their companies and customers, and in some cases, even support suppliers, I hope that they get the recognition that they deserve, because things would not, in fact, have kept rolling without them.
Well, I think there's some hope for that, because mm-hmm. just like in the last 2 years, the 98% of the population that had never uttered the phrase supply chain that now yes. actually has some idea what that is, has to have had some raised awareness of those people and what they do.
Absolutely. Now, Barry, as I prepare to give you back to the rest of your day, for people that are listening to this conversation that are not already connected with you or are just meeting you for the first time through this podcast, where would you suggest that people reach out if they want to connect with you to learn more, to ask a question, something like that? How's the best way to get in touch?
Well, I'm very easily found on LinkedIn. I'm the only Barry Friends on the on the site. But I would also recommend that people visit my firm's website, which is pentalect.com, pentalect.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sourcing Hero podcast. Join us again next time for more true stories of sourcing and business heroism performed by your colleagues and peers. Look for the Sourcing Hero wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe. Finally, don't forget, sourcing heroism is taking place all around us every day. Keep your eyes open and you're bound to see it. Until next time, I'm your host, Kelly Barner. Stay well and always remember that you can be a hero too.